Hello and welcome to Weird. I'm Amy, a nurse.
And I'm Katie, a science writer.
We're cousins and we have an unhealthy obsession with the bizarre side of science.
This is Weird, the podcast.
We're glad you're listening in today. This is Weird, the podcast, where we take a nosedive into the wacky parts of the world.
We each have an odd science topic we've researched, so we will start by flipping a digital coin.
A digital coin.
To Amy's see who presents coin. First.
Okay, flipping. All right, I'm heads.
Yeah.
I'm heads.
Let's do you heads.
It came up tails. You're first.
Okay, so I guess before I jump into my actual topic, a little side note that is a science fact that I learned this week. So I've a lovely little pet snake. Her name is Ada. She's a little yellow corn snake and I love her very much. She's always a very good eater. She eats once a week, but she has refused to eat for almost a month now. And of course I'm all worried and I think, oh no, clearly she's dying. Clearly she has cancer. Yeah. Clearly there's some sort of, she has a parasite. So of course I've debated whether to take her to the vet or not. And I guess in case people aren't familiar with the frequency of snake eating, they could totally go up to even 3 months with no food if needed. So it's not awful that she hasn't eaten for a month, but it's just unusual for her. But anyway, I was doing more research and then I came across, in Snake Reddit, because as we all are on it at some point during the day, perusing through Snake Reddit. I found literally is a Reddit for anything you can imagine and things you can't imagine.
I'm sure. Yeah, there's a Reddit. Probably don't go on those.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Restrain yourself. But yeah, I found some snake Reddits that, other snake owners, and apparently a lot of snakes just stop eating for a month, maybe even two, in the spring during mating season, because they don't want to have a full belly when they meet their mate for the spring and they have to get ready to develop eggs and or find a female mate if it's a male. I think that is fine because she's also very active. She's been doing laps around her enclosure just every day, just laps and laps, and she's refusing
looking
food
for
but
a
she looks
boyfriend.
Yeah, so yeah, she's fine. She's just looking for a man,
I mean,
she
me
wants
too,
to be
girl.
Skinny.
Me too, girl. I
she's just trying to look her summertime best.
Yeah, Ada and I we're right here with that.
Just stop eating for a month and do laps around your tank.
Oh, okay, that's great. Thanks. Yep. Good. Okay,
you
good.
Try that. I'll try it too. Yeah. So anyway, that's totally unrelated to my topic, but just thought that was an interesting little side note fact that is also pretty weird.
Yeah.
So I'll keep everyone updated and let you know when she hopefully eats next. So my real topic is about a very well-loved and very popularized animal that's been in the media and the source of folklore across many cultures. It's the lemming. So I think a lot of people know what lemmings are. They're a tiny little mammal. They're in the same family as rats and mice and hamsters, gerbils, but they're actually closer to a vole than a mouse or hamster. They live a couple years, so similar to a hamster. They're 20 centimeters long. So, they're just a little Arctic hamster. So they are found in very northern parts of the U.S., northern parts of Canada, Norway, Sweden, even Greenland, and some areas of Russia as well. So they live in tundra forests. They can survive really cold temps. They're quite cute, if anyone's seen a picture or a video of a lemming. They literally look like a tiny little wild hamster, and they're fuzzy, and they forage around. They eat grass and moss and berries and roots and shoots, according to my research. So, just setting up for the more disturbing facts to come, the weird facts here to come. So, little mammals that live in the Arctic, they eat all these little grasses and mosses. They have these really cool, elaborate underground burrow systems that have different rooms dedicated to different purposes. So they have an eating room, a sleeping room, a little going to the bathroom room.
Oh my god, they literally have an apartment that's it has a kitchen and a bathroom.
They're so smart. They're very resourceful.
Adorable.
So adorable. And it might be that they, so they don't hibernate. So they need a good place to go to get out of the, you know, tough, cold winters of like the Arctic tundra. So, you know, that potentially is why they have such cool burrow systems that they live in. They're pretty good swimmers, and their fur is waterproof. They typically, and this is where leading up to sort of the weird facts that I'm sure people are waiting for, because when you say lemming, a lot of people think of one thing. Typically
they're like jumping off cliffs.
I know.
To their death.
I know. And wait, just wait until the real sad truth here. So typically, you know, and that image of all those lemmings, like, you know, thousands, millions of lemmings like running around, that doesn't really happen. They really like to be alone. They're not very social, very contrary to those images that we all have in our minds of all those lemmings herding around together and, yes, you know, jumping off cliffs. The exception is, you know, when they go out for mating season, that's, you know, the one time that they choose to not be alone, to go find others around them. And here's a interesting fact about their age when they're ready to start mating. So they're ready to breed as young as 3 weeks old.
What?
So that's how old they have to be to go out and breed.
Excuse me, ma'am.
I know, you are too little.
That just seems a little young to be participating in those types of activities.
So I guess maybe that is the relation to my snake, is that, you know, like, she's out there trying to find mate. These little baby lemmings are out there trying to find mate. So,
except that,
you know,
to be fair, like, Ada is like middle age.
That's true. She's well ready to find herself a man.
She knows what she likes, you know?
Yes.
She knows what she's looking for.
She's felt out the world. She knows who she is. You know, she's not a baby anymore.
Those three-week-old lemmings, so I mean, they're brand new for lemmings.
I know. We should interview a lemming and see how they feel about that, because, yes, that seems a little bit like...
How do, like, the mother lemmings feel about that? You know what I mean? I'm like, I feel like as a mother lemming...
They're probably, like, 6 weeks old.
You know, yeah. So
well, they're pretty young, too. Well, like, the old elderly lemmings are, like, 2 years old. So
yeah, right?
It's, you know, it's a very different scale than us. But yeah, so yeah, there's a little bit of background about our friend the lemming. And yeah, so I think, you know, there's a very stereotypical idea that lemmings throw themselves off a cliff to commit mass suicide, to control their population, or to end the mating season, or whatever it might be. And it's this, like, you know, enduring image, I think, that a lot of us have seen of all thousands of lemmings just like running, and just like mindlessly like following each other and just leaping over a cliff and then going and drowning and or falling into the ocean or falling off this cliff. So it's been this stereotype for many decades, potentially even longer than that.
That's the saying, right? It's like fall, you know, just like doing things like a lemming, you know, which basically means that, you know, you're basically doing something mindlessly or following the crowd. Like, but now also knowing that they mature at 3 weeks old, I kind of also don't blame them for that, because I don't know, if I was like 3 weeks old and like everyone else is doing something, I would probably just do it too. So
it's true. They're just trying to get by. But here's the catch. None of that is true. None of the suicidal lemmings, it's all fake. So this was documented in several places, but the most popular image of this that really is why this is so widespread is a Disney documentary from 1958. It was called White Wilderness. This movie won an Academy Award for Best Documentary. And here's how they filmed this documentary. So it was filmed in Alberta, Canada, which is very far from where lemmings actually live in the wild. So the Disney people, they went to Manitoba, which is a couple like provinces away and in an area that actually has lemmings. And they paid a group of kids 25 cents to go collect about 20 lemmings from the forest. They take these little captive poor lemmings that were taken from their habitat back to Alberta, and they built a turntable, like a Lazy Susan turntable, and they covered it with snow. And they just put them on there, and they were like spinning it, filming it close in to make it look like the lemmings were migrating in large numbers. And then they herded these little lemmings by force over a cliff and filmed them falling to their death.
Okay. So I know that like Disney has been, you know, responsible for a lot of like bad things in the, I can't just like name all of them off the top of my head because like, I don't know, but I just like feel like there's like a general consensus that, you know, like Disney,
Nickelodeon, all those, you know.
But that's pretty fucking bad.
I know. And like, it was a different world in the 1950s. You know, their animal, you know, rights were not quite as supported as they are today, I suppose. And like, this is not very widely known, I feel like. I think most people really do think that lemmings, as part of their natural ecological existence, are supposed to do this, and they actually do that. But
yes, I thought that. Like, I totally thought that. I was like, oh yeah, you're like a lemming, you know, you just like fall off a cliff. You like run out, you know, like
yeah,
terrible. But also, like, you do question that whole like lemming mentality because you're like, that doesn't really make any sense, like evolutionarily.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Like, that doesn't really fucking make any sense for like once a year they just like all like run off of a cliff. Like, that doesn't really.
Yeah.
Why would they do that? That doesn't.
I know. And turns out they do not.
And turns out so, it was all just a big fucking lie.
It's just a huge lie. And I don't know if it's because something, you know, an entity as big as Disney were the ones to produce this documentary and it just that is what got popularized or whatever, but yeah, this is stuck. But the myth itself is even older than this Disney documentary. It goes back to as early as like the 1800s. People like thought weird things about lemmings, like they're a very misunderstood species. And so like, so where did this come from? So there's a couple explanations of, you know, why there's these massive just like misconceptions about lemmings. So first of all, I mentioned, you know, they are pretty good swimmers. They often swim, you know, to migrate to other areas or to go look for food or whatever. But they're not very good at swimming for a really long time. And, you know, they don't have super big brains. So like they don't always know how long that swim is. And they often, you know, misinterpret how long it's going to take them to swim, you know, across a body of water. Maybe they, you know, reach some current waters that they, you know, get stuck in or something like that. So their intent is never to try to die. Their intent is to try to migrate, find food, find a mate. But they do drown sometimes because they are trying to swim across the water. And so, you know, sometimes people would see these dead lemmings in the water and they would, you know, incorrectly assume, oh, well, they must have jumped. Clearly they weren't just trying to swim to like get somewhere and then accidentally die. No, they definitely jumped on purpose.
Clearly they just jumped off a cliff in a massive suicide attempt. And that's why they're finding all these dead lemmings washed ashore.
Yep. You know, science was different back then, you know, you just had an idea and like, oh, that must be right. Like, oh, let's not test it. Let's not look into it any further.
That's actually the only explanation that we have at this point. So yeah. That's probably what it was.
So that's one source, you know, potential source of this myth. Another one is they, as you can imagine, have a lot of predators. They're this tiny little rodent. So they get hunted by like hawks and owls and foxes, and they, you know, they'll hunt them, but they'll kind of eat them very like frantically and like messily, like aggressively, and like leave chunks of lemming around because they're trying to like scarf them down. And so people would also see that, like, you know, chunks of lemmings around. And again, assume, oh, well, clearly they, you know, must have tried to kill themselves.
Jumped off the cliff to their death.
They clearly must have. and the other fact about the way that their populations go that could have caused this myth is that their population fluctuates like a lot by like tenfold over every few years. And this has nothing to do with them killing themselves, but rather predators, food, climate, like, and ecologically, they're just sort of designed to like fluctuate, to have a bunch of them. And then, you know, they get eaten off by predators. And then maybe the next year there's not as many and then they come back. So they fluctuate a lot. So when people noticed they're like, hey, last year there was like so many lemmings. Oh, there's like only like a tenth of the lemmings out. I wonder what happened. They must have jumped off a cliff.
They must have just jumped off a cliff. They must have just jumped off a cliff.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of misconceptions. But those were not the only misconceptions. So that's definitely the most well-known one about them jumping off a cliff. But another myth is that they explode. That apparently has been a myth for like
centuries. I have
centuries.
Heard that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, tell me more about
it's
that.
Not, it's not true.
I assumed, so it seems weird.
And I couldn't find a lot about why that myth like originated, but they can be like aggressive with each other during mating season. And they do like their fur like rips out and stuff sometimes. And, you know, again, like if they're like attacked by predators, like there can be like little, you know, chunks of their fur and skin around. So clearly when they saw the chunks of lemming, they're like, instead of thinking that maybe this was because the lemmings were fighting or the lemmings were, you know, predated upon.
Oh, because they
clearly explode. That's the only logical explanation. And then actually that's related to another myth is that they just fall from the sky. Again, I couldn't really find exactly why that one originated, but I assume it's the same kind of thing. They saw like some dead lemmings sitting around or whatever.
Okay, so
yeah.
I do feel like I need to like go to this place where lemmings, you know, like where lemmings just live, because I just feel like there's a lot of like chunks of lemming. Just like there just must be just like chunks of lemming. Just
I know. How many pieces? Yeah. How many chunks lemming, can there be really?
Like to the point where like we have to start making theories about where did the chunks of lemmings come from? Fell off a cliff, or they fell out of the sky, or they just imploded.
Now, clearly, that's the only explanation for this. yeah, poor lemmings. And yeah, I was thinking about that. Like, if I was hiking around the Arctic tundra and I saw a little dead rodent or whatever it is, I would assume, oh, maybe he was sick. Maybe he was hunted by something, you know. I don't think my assumption ever would be he clearly killed himself.
My assumption would definitely be that he spontaneously combusted and exploded. Yeah. Yep. And just chunks of himself just like all over the place. I mean, that would be my assumption immediately. Yep. So
you know, it's a lesson to modern science and people who do this a lot. I mean, you know, there's still even people in modern day that just assume things are fact because they came up with this theory in their head. And this is why peer-reviewed science is superior to random guesses.
I mean, but even so, like even with, because like, obviously like this Disney documentary, quote unquote, that came out was like, it happened in like the 50s, you know? Right. And like, we still believe this, like to this day, it's what 70 some years later, and like people still say lemmings, and like we still think of like all of these little hamster type creatures that just like are flowing off of a cliff.
I know,
you know, like that's still like a thing that we think about.
It's the power of marketing and a gullible public, you know, that they saw this and they just, you know, took it as fact. So
yeah, that's crazy.
I know. And also feel very bad for those lemmings. And like, I had seen that clip before of the lemmings, you know, falling off the cliff. And I thought it was sad, but like not tragic. Cause the first time I saw that, I thought, oh, that's like what they're supposed to do. They evolved to do this. So it's like, oh, well, that's kind of sad, but oh, I guess that's how they are supposed to do that. Now that I know that literally human beings were forcing these poor little animals to like jump off the cliff and they're terrified, and they were like literally shipped in a van purchased for 25 cents from some kids that caught them from the wild, and then they were put on a turntable Lazy Susan, filmed, and then thrown off a cliff.
Okay. Yeah.
Poor lemmings. So
poor lemmings, man.
I know. I feel so bad. But anyway, so that's my lemming story.
So really, like, lemmings, I feel like, they're just, like, regular, cute, rodent-type, hamstery little animals, and they just like live and like do their thing, and they don't jump off cliffs. I don't know, maybe the lemmings liked the claim to fame. I don't know, because otherwise they're just kind of like voles. Like, I don't know, what do you know about voles?
They're cuter than voles. They have a really cute fur pattern, but I mean, they do, if anything we should like rebrand being a lemming as to like a brave little creature who, like, you know, despite being abused by people around it, despite, you know, living in harsh conditions of conditions of the Arctic, you know, still presses forward and tries to live. And they, you know, think they can swim further than they can. They try anyway, even though they might not make it. That's what a lemming is.
So be like a lemming, you guys.
Be like a lemming.
Whenever anyone accuses you of being like a lemming because you're like following the crowd, be like, fuck no, I am being like a lemming by following my own intuition and surviving conditions that are against me. So there.
Yes. We should. Should we get t-shirts made?
That's I know.
Be a lemming.
Yeah, should we get like, yeah, should we have like stickers or something?
Rebrand the lemmings.
Yeah, I feel like, so we're gonna, yeah, we should like make some stickers and we're gonna, we should like, yeah, we'll like, we'll sell them on our website that we're gonna make.
Yeah,
because guess what? We're totally like lemmings and we make shit happen for ourselves.
Yes.
Despite conditions that are adversary, so.
Exactly. We lemmings, goddammit.
Yeah, we're like lemmings.
Other little fun fact, there's something called lemming fever, which is a disease that humans can get if you're bit by a lemming. It's called, more commonly known as, I'm going to butcher all the pronunciation, but tularemia. It's a bacterial disease. And yeah, if you get bit by a lemming, you will have fever, ulcers, swelling of the lymph nodes, breathing difficulties.
Well,
so don't get bit by one.
Well, I hope that all of the people that made those lemmings jump off the cliff got tularemia.
I know.
Tularemia.
I wonder if some of them did.
I mean, I bet that little boy did. He was the one that had to
catch them all. I know. Like, and yeah, the fact that they like paid kids to, but like, also, it's just like this is unethical on so many levels.
Like, yeah, also like child labor and just like, you know,
it's like, how was this not a crime at this entire thing altogether?
Well, I mean, it was like the 1950s also. So like basically you could do whatever you wanted. I mean,
people smoked on planes, you know, like people just weren't making good decisions.
Like nurses smoked at the nurse's station in the 1950s. And you know, I mean, it's another time. It was a wild, it's just wild times.
Wild
time. It's honestly why we have laws now.
Right. Yeah.
Because of
I
all
know.
The shit that happened back then.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's sadly, I think that is the story
for the lemmings. All right. Mm-hmm. All right. So the moral of the story is, you guys, like, don't like accuse anyone of being a lemming anymore unless you're like empowering them, because lemmings are awesome.
Right. Lemmings are awesome and adorable. And,
yeah, and they're really cute.
Yep. And not suicidal at all.
And yeah.
And full of bacteria that can give you
and yeah. And also
So don't touch them. Yeah. And definitely don't force them to jump off a cliff and put them on a turntable in a studio and film them with the
just
camera.
Don't like put them on like a Lazy Susan type like merry-go-round.
Yep. Yeah, don't do that.
Okay. So my thing. Sorry, I'm still just like getting over like the lemmings on the Lazy Susan's merry-go-round.
I know.
Okay. All right, moving on. We're moving on from that. Okay, so the thing I'm going to talk about is this study that they did. It's been studies like over many, many years, but there was like one article that I read about it that essentially says that people that are born blind do not get schizophrenia. There has never been...
I think I've heard about this.
There has never been a person in the record, just like of history, that has been born blind that was schizophrenic.
Wow.
Which is like,
why?
Yeah. And that's the real question though, right? Is because now we're talking about like brain structures and what parts of the brain are affected by being blind and being schizophrenic. And also like this study showed too that if you are born with eyesight, you do not have the same protective factor as being born blind against schizophrenia. Like there are plenty of people that have been born with eyesight and then maybe they lost their eyesight later in life for whatever reason, or even early in life, like there was a like a 6-year-old who like was born with eyesight and then lost his eyesight when he's like 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And he still developed schizophrenia later in life. So this protective factor with the blindness, it only applies if you are born without eyesight.
Okay, interesting. And that counts even if you were born with a condition that, you know, it was, you were surely going to lose your eyesight later. Like it wasn't an accident or something. It was like, what is it? Retinitis pigmentosa or something like that, where like you were had vision and then you slowly lost it into your early life.
Yeah.
So even those people do not have this protective. You have to be born with no vision from the get-go.
With no vision from the get-go, you have never seen anything in your life. Like this is a person that you can't describe colors to because they've never seen it. Right.
Okay.
So, gotcha. And I think too, like, I feel like obligated to like, just talk about schizophrenia for a second, because there's so many different forms of being schizophrenic. Like being schizophrenic is not just like one blanket statement. I mean, it manifests as so many different things, you know, from hearing things that aren't there to seeing things that aren't there to just like being really delusional about what's going on around you. I mean, it's a very broad set of symptoms, like schizophrenia, and nobody's schizophrenia is the same. I have met plenty of people that are schizophrenic and none of them have schizophrenia in the exact same way.
Right. And even the degree, there are some people who are debilitated by how severe their schizophrenia is, and then other people who can still live a fairly normal life and have a job and a family and everything. So
there's a huge spectrum of just like what the symptoms are and how severe they are. And there's just this very broad range, which actually makes it more interesting to me that nobody that's been born blind has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, because I'm like, it's such a broad range of disease. You know, there's so many ways that you can be schizophrenic.
Right.
And it ranges from, you know, like auditory hallucinations to visual hallucinations to like delusional thinking and things, you know, just like there's all sorts
paranoia.
Of paranoia. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of different ways that you can be schizophrenic. And I just thought it was really interesting, first of all, that anyone who's been born blind, they just have never had a diagnosis of schizophrenia ever.
Yeah. How many people are we talking though? Cause I've worked in a disability services office before. So I know many people who are blind, and most of the people who I know that are blind still had some vision when they were young and gradually lost it. Or obviously a lot of, you know, blindness happens because of, you know, an accident or an injury, but yeah, it's much more rare. I feel like in the scheme of like how many blind people there are, the people who are born 100% blind, and also blindness is a spectrum too. If we're talking about, you know, things on a spectrum, like people can be literally no vision at all to, you know, they have like a little dot of vision. They have blurriness on this side. They have no distance vision. They, you know, like that's, blindness is a huge spectrum too. So, but we're talking about like literal.
It's a small percentage of people that we're talking about, because basically we're talking about people that just have never seen it ever in their life. They just don't see. And that is like, that's a smaller percentage of people who are blind versus, you know, the entire blind population as it exists, because a lot of people have sight when they're younger or they lose it for some reason, but essentially to have this protective factor against schizophrenia, you have to have never seen anything ever in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, just talking about even just that small portion of people, like schizophrenia is prevalent enough that we would have thought, you know, some of those people would be affected.
So in the study, it's still like statistically significant that there aren't any born blind people that got schizophrenia. Like it's like the math checks out that it actually is, that means something, that it's not just such a low number.
Yeah. It's still very statistically significant that like, it's zero.
Yeah.
You know, that just having people be born blind, it's a 0% chance that they can get schizophrenia. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't get other mental health disorders. Like being autistic is actually higher if you're born blind. And like things like savantism is like, especially like auditory savantism, like musical savants, is you have a higher rate of like auditory savants in people that are blind, which kind of makes sense, right? Because
it's heightened.
Because like your sense of hearing is heightened if one of your other senses is taken away. So I can't remember like what the percentage was, but it was like a much higher percentage of blind people have perfect pitch versus people that are, you know, like here that are, you know, have sight. So, you know, so there is like that correlation between like having these other heightened senses and then like autism too. Like there are, autism is like associated with having blindness as well. Mm-hmm. Like there's a correlation between those things that says that if you're blind, you're more likely to be autistic.
Okay.
So
like a comorbidity or whatever that term is.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought it was fascinating that there's literally never been a case of someone who was born blind and then they were later diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like and so do they have any initial theories as to why? Like, I guess that would make sense that they wouldn't have like visual hallucinations, obviously, but yeah, that they wouldn't also have any form of schizophrenia, even auditory hallucinations or
paranoia. Because I feel like auditory hallucinations are actually fairly common. I have plenty of patients and stuff. Like for those of the people, the listeners that don't know, like I'm a nurse, but I'm a psych nurse. And so I work with a lot of patients with schizophrenia and like other psych disorders. But I feel like auditory hallucinations are really common. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have seen plenty of people just responding to, you know, internal auditory stimuli. Like that happens pretty often. It's very, you know, and so I would think that, you know, like even if you were blind, you would still be able to have things like auditory hallucinations, but that's just not the case. That's just not something that anyone has ever found to be true. You know, like if you're born blind, something about your brain is different that prevents you from having this distortion of reality. And the other thing that the study had showed was, so your visual cortex is in your occipital lobe, which is like that lobe at the back of your brain. I always think of it as like being like the butt of the brain. I mean, it's just like if the brain was like a person, like that's where its butt would be.
That will always be something I visualize literally for the rest of my life. The little butt of my brain.
Like if your brain was like in a twerk, like it would be shaking its occipital lobe. Like
so, you know those comics where they're like, how would this animal wear pants? You know, they show a giraffe or like some animal that has never worn pants and say, how would this animal wear pants realistically? Yeah, so now we know. If your brain wore pants, wear pants on that part.
It would wear pants on its occipital lobe because that's, you know. So the visual cortex, it exists in like the occipital lobe, which is back here. And so there's part of the study that said that people that are blind, we actually like, they have thicker visual cortexes in their occipital lobe, which essentially means not necessarily that part of the brain is bigger, but that it has gone through what we call less pruning.
Oh.
Through seeing things and realizing what is true, like visually, and then like the brain like changes itself and prunes off the parts that are useless.
Okay. So it's almost, it's not refined. It's just this chunk of occipital lobe.
It's like this chunk of meat that like, you know, has some electrical signals that goes through it.
It hasn't been tuned. It hasn't been pruned.
Yeah. Okay. But it hasn't been like pruned the way that, you know, normal people have pruned their visual cortex. And then they looked at the occipital lobes in schizophrenic people. Those people have some of them at least have like overly pruned occipital, like visual cortexes in their occipital lobe. So there's something about just having like just the right amount of pruning of that lobe that makes you not have schizophrenia and makes you not blind.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, like when you said it was, you know, denser or whatever, you know, I imagined like, wait, that's odd because like, wouldn't it be stronger? But yeah, it's like, it's not about, your brain is such a delicate gelatinous thing in there. And it's not about being stronger or bigger. It's about being, you know, very exact. And our brain does all these very precise things in it. And that obviously we don't 100% understand and maybe never will, but that's fascinating.
Yeah. And I think too, like the thing about the brain that I personally really love is that you can change the health of your brain by like what stimulus you put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so, that's in a way that's like, that's similar to, you know, your organs and your bones and stuff like that. Like, obviously, like if we feed our pancreas, like, and our liver, like a lot of alcohol, like it's not going to be as healthy, you know, but like the brain, you know, it's the stimulus that we give it is not so much physical as it is like conceptual. And if we think of like pruning our brains, that's just a thing that happens to us as we look at the world and we observe the world. And then this part of our brain actually changes in response to that.
Yeah.
That's like, that's crazy to me.
That is insane. So, and is it like, is that why schizophrenia can like becomes progressively worse, like over a person's life without treatment and, you know, the proper type of care, like that usually they get worse because their brain continues to over prune? Or?
Yeah. I think that's probably true for some people. And that's like, that's again, like on the, just like, as a blanket statement of people being schizophrenic, like it's different for everybody, you know? Right, some people are just like, some people, like they can get stabilized with their schizophrenia really easily. And then they can maybe in later in their life, they like go off their meds and they're fine. And then there's other people who like, they stay on their meds and they stay on their meds and they stay the course. And then later in their life, the meds stop working. And then they're back in like this place of non-reality. And so, but yeah, it implies so many things about, you know, like the brain and how the brain works and how the brain develops because we see.
Right.
I mean, and that implies a lot of other things too about like our other senses. I think that like, I mean, you know, just the input that we have, like the sensory input that we take in our bodies shapes the way that our brain works.
Right. That probably evolves a lot too, that like, you know, people used to see the outdoors more. They used to have like a wide variety of like visual experiences and stimulus.
Totally.
And now so many people, even from childhood, are staring at screens for like literally most of the day. And I mean, I'm obviously guilty of that. I work on a computer all day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, typically I even relax by looking at other screens when I'm not working. So as most of us do. So is that, I wonder,
yeah,
I'm sure there's studies all about that, but.
I mean, I think that this whole thing implies like a huge, it just kind of like opens this like can of worms.
Yeah.
Because it's like, what are we, you know, what kind of things are we stimulating like in our brains in terms of like pruning and developing like in different parts of our brains, because it's very like, you know, like we all have monsters in our brains, you know, like we all have these monsters, you know, that plague us, but the ones that get strong are the ones that you feed, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so like, what are we, what kinds of things are we feeding by, you know, staring at screens or just staring at anything?
Of, you know? Watching lemming documentaries.
What is watching lemming documentaries? What is doing? Yeah. So,
so then that's so interesting to think about that. Okay. So we've found this connection that no one who was born blind developed schizophrenia, specific, you know, symptom, specific disease. So what else, like if you were born deaf, for example, are there certain other mental, you know, disorders that you might not develop if you were born deaf or born without the ability to taste or smell or whatever. Is there other connections that we just haven't discovered yet?
So I think, because when I was reading this study, it said, that there is a higher level of savantism, in people that are blind. And I was like, does that also mean that other types of savants, I've gone to school with people who were savants in math per se, or music, but they could see. And I've gone to school with people like that. And I'm like, do those people also then have some kind of protective factor against something like schizophrenia? Logically, you're like, if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, right?
Right.
So there, there's kind of that question that I would ask, if you're more likely to be a savant if you're born blind, are you less likely then to get schizophrenia if you're a savant?
Right.
Anything.
Yeah. It's like all these things exist. There's all these observations, and we're still trying to figure out where those connections are. Like, what impacts this? Did they develop together and that's why it's like that? Or did one cause the other, or the other way around? Or what is the exact woven relationship between all these conditions?
We have all of these conditions, that we have recognized as being part of brain development and the way that the brain works. But how do all of those things fit together? Because,
and I think Titus has opinions about this. Yeah. If anyone's wondering,
Titus, what Titus the little has ones so are. Many opinions down here with his.
Yes. Yes. If people hear little sounds, it's not Amy's stomach. It's a very cute, fluffy doggy.
Yeah, that wants my attention. There's another one over here, actually, too. There's two of them.
They're podcasters, too.
Yeah, they're podcasters.
We should get them little headphones.
I know.
Why do I have a feeling Titus would totally like noise-canceling headphones?
Titus probably loves the noise-canceling headphones. So I often, speaking of people that are autistic, I often tell people, that Titus has autism. And that's autism for dogs. And he doesn't, process sensory things the same way. And sometimes he gets upset and needs to be comforted. And he just,
he's got autism and we love
him. He has autism and we love him. And he has special ways that we need to, make his life so that he can be happy. And that's okay.
So he's not afraid of certain textures of carpets, shapes of windows.
Because sometimes we get really scared about certain textures of, flooring and even some cements we can't walk on because those are scary or they feel bad on our paws. Or sometimes there's one time last Halloween when one of the trees at one of the neighbor's house, got TP'd and we couldn't go down that street for 3 weeks because, the scary tree, that was terrifying. That was too scary. You know what? Aren't we all a little bit neurodivergent?
We're talking about a spectrum on a lot of these things. And
we literally have a podcast called Weird because nobody in our family wants to listen to us talk about all of our weird things.
We just record ourselves talking.
So we just talk about them and broadcast it to the entire world.
Yeah, there we go. That's our solution. Because we're lemmings.
Because we're lemmings. Blazing our own trail. Not just following the crowd. Be a lemming.
Yeah, I feel like that maybe should be our catchphrase. Be a lemming, and people will be like, what does it have to do with anything? And then they'll listen to the episode and
and then they'll be like,
be weird.
Be weird, be a lemming. Thanks for joining us today on Weird, the podcast.
You can contact us on Instagram at weird.podcast.
Subscribe to us on YouTube, Weird, the podcast.
Or shoot us an email at thepodcastweird@gmail.com.
Thanks, everyone. It's been weird.
our 7 listeners depend on this consistency.
You're right.
We
you're
have
right.
to do it perfectly.
You're right. You're right. We should be the best for our 7 listeners, you know.
I know.
Where we take a Oh, sorry. Okay, wait. Let me Should have had this pulled up.
It's the same family as like rice. Not rice. I was looking at mice and rats, and I said rice.
I mean, we are both half Chinese, so we do love rice.
That's true.
I'm literally eating rice right now while we record this podcast.